Let's see, shall it be trick or treat today on Scribble?
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweep.
And I'm Don Wooten. Interested in Halloween reading material? Then talk to Mark McLaughlin, which is what we'll do before hearing from Garrison Keillor and the Writer's Almanac on Scribble. Mark McLaughlin, you scary guy.
Hello, Don. Hello, Roald. Blah!
You have been at this game a long time, because I think I heard you way back, I don't know, it was either the 60s or 70s, but it was shortly after I came to Augustana College, back when all of a sudden little coffee houses became popular, coffee houses with little house bands and stuff, and there was a group called Take Five that I think I first actually heard you at. And I would swear in my memory, you think it was Rock Island, I think it was Davenport. But how long have you been doing what you're doing?
I've been writing for various publishers since I was, my first published work was at age 18, which of course means I've been doing it for 7 years. give or take several decades.
Nicely done, Mark.
But almost all of your work is in the horror genre, isn't it?
Oh, I would say like either horror or science fiction or fantasy, dark fantasy, but a lot of whimsy in there too. I mean, I'm not one to write great gouts of gore. There's usually some whimsy in there. Like, for example, in my latest book, which I'll hold up to the microphone and then realize it's not a camera, Dracula Transformed. Many of the stories, they're all stories about vampires written with my colleague, Michael McCarty. Many of them are scary and, you know, very serious horror, but there's also some stories of whimsy in there too.
Like, but they tend to be dark, don't they?
They all do, yeah. Yeah. But for example, there's a story in here, Dracula has risen from the sofa. So that won't scare anybody too much. People with heart problems can read that one. Safely.
What's wrong with you, Mark?
I've wondered that for years.
I guess what I'm asking is, what's the appeal of horror fiction?
My Greek grandmother on my mother's side was a woman who would, when I was little, I'd visit her at her apartment, and she would tell me wonderful tales of Greek mythology. And then she would, and then we'd make up a little more story as we went along. I think she got tired of, couldn't remember the details, and I think she'd want me to fill in the gaps for her. My most wonderful conversation I can remember was in the stories of Greek mythology. She would tell me, she would mix in contemporary religion with the Greek mythology. And in one conversation I remember to this day, because it perplexed me so much of the time. She would say that Zeus was married to the goddess Hera. But Zeus was God. And I would say, well, then how's the Virgin Mary figure into that configuration? And she said, that's some gal he met. I'm trying to figure that out in my head. So
this streak runs in the family, right?
I guess on the mother's side, yeah. My grandmother would tell me. And her versions of Greek mythology, you know, occasionally they'd stop for a drink, you know. So she made it up as she went along.
What appeals to you about horror fiction? I mean, it has been for 300 years in Western literature a popular genre. And various people. I was thinking, when knowing we were going to interview you, I went back and looked at Mrs. Anne Radcliffe, the Castle of Otranto, one of the first purveyors of Gothic literature. And what she thought she was doing is to bring the thrill and excitement of Shakespeare back to a dull age.
I got right on that.
She was serious. And what she said was, what I want to do is awaken thrilling horror, to get people to feel again. Mm-hmm. Right?
Her and me, same goal. Yeah.
Okay, well.
We're right on the same ticket.
What are you trying to do? I mean, what do you want an audience to do when they read something that you've written?
I want them to say, well, that was good. I wish they'd make a movie out of it. And then when they make the movie out of it, I hope they pay Mark quite a lot of money.
Okay.
But no, so but it's not so much about whether or not it's made into a movie someday. I mean, that'd be great, but I'm not holding my breath. I just want to write exciting tales that people read just for the sheer enjoyment. Just like I enjoyed making up stories with my grandma and listening to her version of Greek mythology. You know, just for the enjoyment of the tradition of storytelling, really.
Did you ever go through an H.P. Lovecraft period?
I've written several books of H.P. Lovecraft stories.
I guess that's right.
I'm considered one of today's leading proponents of H.P. Lovecraft kind of stuff.
Yeah, Mark, let me get to the technical side. Every author has an approach or technique or process. What is yours? Do you write every day? Do you write when the inspiration strikes on assignment or deadline? What moves you to write?
Oh, just because I want to. And I do it at night and after I get off work. And then I do it on the weekends. And sometimes I even do it a little bit before work. I just do it all the time. But I don't do it for my full-time job, because if I did it for my full-time job, then it wouldn't be my mistress anymore. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
It's the thing I escape to. But if it was what I did all the time, then I couldn't escape to it, because then it would not be this exciting thing I did on the side. It would just be the thing I did. You know what I mean? It wouldn't be the allure wouldn't be there anymore.
Well, you know, some of us, when we have spare time, indulge in open-mouth air breathing.
I've heard of that. I don't know if I can know it, really.
There are these strange people who write who just can't stop writing. And
I have people helping me, too. You know, I often collaborate with, as you can see from this beautifully designed book cover, I also often collaborate with Michael McCarty. And I also collaborate with another friend of mine named Michael Sheehan Jr. And in fact, over the years, I've collaborated with about like four or five different guys named Michael. I don't know what it is about the name Michael, but I just seem to collaborate with a lot.
It sounds as if it's an Irish mafia you've got going there.
Sure and Begorra.
Sure and Begorra. That's what they mean.
I'm actually a leprechaun on little stilts.
Is that what they mean by the black Irish?
Why don't you...
Steeped in midnight wickedness, yes.
Go ahead and give us a sample of some of your writing so people have some idea of what we're talking about here.
Oh, my goodness. Where does one begin? With such a rich treasure trove in which to delve. I'm so demure, it's ridiculous, really. Shy is the word, yes. Okay, I'll read from Dracula Has Risen from the Sofa.
Okay.
Okay, good.
Written by myself and Michael McCarty. Morgula, the oldest of Dracula's three undead wives, pursed her luscious crimson lips as she threw a sofa pillow at him. She was a stocky blonde with bangs that nearly covered her deep-set violet eyes. "Get up already, you bloated human tick," she cried. "We should never have had cable installed. All you do is watch that stupid flat-screen TV, night after night after night of the living dead." Dracula replied with a hearty belch, flinging the drained carcass of yet another elderly villager into the blazing fireplace. "Blah, blah, blah. Get down to that retirement complex and get me another victim. And pick one out with some meat on his bones. That last one was too scrawny." The rotund count then grabbed the remote and searched the channels until he found a rerun of The Sunset Girls, a program about four plucky elderly women sharing a ranch-style house. "Hey, that's my favorite show." "Yeah, every show's your favorite show," Morgula said. "No, really, look at those silver foxes. Daddy likes." Dracula rubbed his puffy, pale hands together. "They may be old bats, but they're younger than you three. Now hurry down to that retirement complex and get me a lady this time. Find one that looks like that tall broad on TV. What a hottie. Maybe we should get a place like theirs. No stairs. This old castle has way too many grand stairways." See, he has a domestic side to his life. Domestic. And with three wives, you know. It's all one, but there's two more, too.
I think the whole tribe of Dracula would be outraged by this irreverent treatment.
Did you know that in real life, Dracula, or Vlad Tepes, the warrior upon whom Dracula was based, had a daughter?
Had a daughter?
Had a daughter. In real life, he had a daughter named Zaleska.
No, I have not read about Vlad the Impaler very much. It's a it's a lacuna in my.
I thought you had an education. What? Say what? He had a daughter named Zaleska, and in fact, the Universal film Dracula's Daughter pays a little homage to that by calling his daughter Countess Zaleska.
Mm-hmm.
But in real life, his daughter's name was Zaleska with a Z. And in the first story in the book, which is a very serious story, which is entitled, let's see, how would I know? I just wrote it. But I wrote it with Mike. He knows the other half. Well, the first story is called Lucy Transformed. And in the last story is called Dracula Transformed. And in the first one, in Lucy Transformed, Lucy being his main victim when he comes to England in the original novel, we find the story is told through a series of letters in Lucy Transformed, a series of letters to Dracula to his daughter Zaleska, who lives in Paris. And so in this story, which is a serious story, not like that other one, a serious story, we get to see the fatherly side of Dracula, that he actually, how he interacts with his daughter and what his daughter is up to and the letters that go to his daughter. We only see the letters that go to the daughter. We don't see the daughter's letters from the daughter. It's all the ones.
Do you do much research on this? Have you read all?
Tons of research.
Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah. One of the first books, I was kind of a little protege when I was little. You know, I could read adult books when I was like only about like 5 or 6 years old. And one of the first books I read was Dracula. And so I've been reading and researching all this stuff ever since.
Mm-hmm.
And it was funny, when I was little, my mom, I was only like about like third grade or something like this, and my mom... I said, give me a book to read over recess. And I think it was either Peyton. Oh, no, it was Valley of the Dolls. Valley of the Dolls. And the teacher was so mad. What is a child doing reading such pornography? And I said, well, they're not. They got their clothes on. It's not pornography. Well,
you know, you're looking at a guy whose mother was an English teacher and who had to read science fiction by flashlight under the bedclothes late at night, let alone horror fiction. I mean, she would have been horrified. Apparently, your parents were a little more liberal then.
Oh, my mom. She didn't care. My mom, they called her and got her down there, and she was furious. And she was like, I'm missing my stories. What is this? I'm missing my stories. Why did you drag me down here? What did he do? And they said, he was reading this. And she's like, yeah, I gave it to him. Give it back. Let him read it. And they're like, aren't you concerned that it has adult themes? And she was like, and I was there, so I heard all this. And she said, he'll find out eventually. Save me having to explain it. I'm going to get going. My stories are starting in about 15 minutes. And I'd like to think that reading Valley of the Dolls at age 7 didn't warp me too much. Of course, I'm writing this stuff. So
I think Dracula warped you.
I read that right. I think that was after Valley of the Dolls.
Does the market for
kind
horror
warm me up? So.
Does the market for horror fiction go up and down? I mean, is it more popular
consistent today,
or has it been consistent over the years?
Yeah, it's consistent. I mean, people either like it or they don't. It's not like a
well. Who is the, is there a specific market that for horror fiction that?
Oh, sure.
I mean, Don says he's, you know, hasn't read much of it at all. What is that market? Like for
smart
science
people.
Fiction, for science, you know, when I was
and of course you're smart too.
When I was growing up, the market for science fiction was people like me, nerds and geeks that, you know, couldn't get dates, and that's science fiction has really expanded out. Is horror fiction done the same thing, gone out into?
I think everybody reads it, and people who say they don't read it, they're still reading it. They just say they don't. Oh, rump, I would never read that. I mean, otherwise, why would Stephen King be a big bestseller?
Well,
you know?
Exactly.
He's
right.
So, like,
right.
Sells 1 million books every 5 seconds. So, you know, somebody's, somebody's buying them.
About how many books have you written, Mark?
Over the years?
Yeah.
Oh, about somewhere around like 38.
Whoa.
38 books.
Yeah. I don't promote them locally very much, though. You dragged me out of my solitude for this interview.
I see.
Because I'd market them in other communities and stuff like that. Yeah, I've traveled quite a lot, you know. In fact, in any given year, more people buy my books in England than they do in the Quad Cities.
Really?
Yeah, I actually have a little following in England. Because, you know, I don't feel like a person should have to limit themselves to one community. And maybe I'm wrong. Maybe this area does have a bigger horror readership than I imagined. But I think I often think, well, this they'd probably sell better in this, that, or the other community. And so
that's interesting.
I concentrate on those.
A friend of mine who's no longer with us, Gail Brown, who wrote as Margaret Fraser, is very popular in England.
Oh.
Yeah. She writes historical things that are so accurate they use them in college classes. But, you know, she made an exact study, and all her books remain in print, but they're very popular in England, more so than in this country. But that's because she's kind of preaching to the choir, and I guess maybe there's something about the English that you're preaching to them, too. There's this.
Well, that's where horror fiction began,
yeah.
Essentially.
The home of Jack the Ripper. Yeah. And yeah.
Once one of my books was number 11 English-speaking horror book on Kindle in Japan.
Really?
For like 2 days. It was some little fluke. For for 2 days in Japan, it was like a big readership, and then it went away never to return. I don't even know why.
How do your books get translated into other countries? How do they get published in other countries?
Oh, well, no, I mean like the Kindle versions.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, and all those, and they're not translated. They're still in English.
Yeah.
But all those countries do have, even Japan has English-speaking people in it. And so that's probably the percentage of people in Japan who are English-speaking Kindle readers is not gigantically huge. So that's probably why I was able to jump so high in the English-speaking Kindle ratings for 2 days and then sink lower. I don't know what happened that weekend. Yeah. Maybe they had a phenomenal streak of good taste that week.
Well, Dracula Transformed is the movie. As we've told you, Mark has been doing some books.
Oh, it's not a movie yet. It's a book.
What?
It's not a movie yet. It's a book.
Oh, well. I'm just trying to promote you here.
You're giving me a psychic moment there, I think. Yeah. I think you were looking ahead, you know. Since you're having that psychic moment, who are they cast as Dracula? Is it that Channing Tatum guy everybody's all the rage about?
Well, for the moment, it's a book. And you can get it. Mark McLaughlin's Dracula Transformed, approximately number 38 of a series of horror books that Mark has written, and you can probably find them and scare yourself to death.
Oh, yeah, you can go to any bookstore. I mean, Dracula Transformed is from Wildside Press, which is a national publisher. So all you have to do is just go to any bookstore and say Dracula Transformed by Mark McLaughlin and Michael McCarty from Wildside Press, and they can look it up and buy it and get it for you. And
okay, well, we'll let you go back to curl in your coffin now. Thank you, Mark.
Wearing sunscreen 948 or something.
And with that, we will adjourn to our good friend Garrison Keillor, and he will bring us the Writer's Almanac. Support for Writer's Almanac on WVIK comes from the Mississippi Valley Regional Blood Center, working together with volunteer donors to provide blood products and services to hospitals throughout the region. Information at bloodcenter.org. Now we're going to saunter over to the book bag, and we'll have a little traveling music for that. Roll Tweed is here, and he has the book bag open. And what do you?
Well, I have
an
announcement first of all, too. Laura Winton, whom we interviewed a few weeks back about her performance poetry, is trying something totally new in the way of area poetry reading. It's a poetry reading for over the next first and third Wednesdays of the month until December 5th at a laundromat. It's called the Coin Op Poetry Reading. So every first and third Wednesday from 9 in the morning until 12 at noon at 14th Avenue and 42nd Street at the laundromat there, there will be a poetry reading. Come and listen to poetry. Come and bring your poetry. Do your laundry.
This is in Rock Island?
This is in Rock Island up on 14th Avenue.
I have used that laundromat in the past.
But you're missing the poetry.
Yeah, well, it's...
So Laura Winton is, you know, she is always doing about 1,000 different things, and but they all have to do with the arts and poetry, and this is one of them. It reminds me of a Richard Wilbur, one of my favorite Richard Wilbur poems is a poem called Love Calls Us to the Things of This World, in which a person the narrator, wakes up, and in his half a week state, he's in a slum section of the city where you hang laundry between the across the alley between the buildings. And he looks out and sees these white things fluttering, and he thinks it's angels. And then he wakes up and said, oh, no, it's just grubby laundry, and I got to wake up to this world. And then as he thinks about it, he realizes that really for all of us outside our windows, there are both angels and laundry, and that that's good.
Uh-huh.
Great poem.
Oh,
but come up and get some interesting poems.
Okay, very good. And get your clothes clean, too.
Yes.
But what about the book bag? Anything to recommend today?
Virginia Wayne has suggested, one. Some of you know because we've talked about it on Saturday Morning Live, we raised a monarch caterpillar into a butterfly here at the station, in part because of we were partaking in Tallgrass Quad Cities, which is aimed at getting monarch habitats going. Virginia Wayne called in knowing that with three books for kids that she would recommend that have to do with monarch butterflies, and I'll give those to you very briefly. The Very Hungry Caterpillar by Eric Carl, C-A-R-L-E. Fly Butterfly by Bonnie Bader, B-A-D-E-R. And Where Butterflies Grow by Joanne Ryder, R-Y-D-E-R. So if you want to read, if your kids think they want to read about monarch butterflies, those, she says, are three really very good books for kids.
Okay. Anything for adults?
For adults, there's a Nan Carter sent a book this time that's funny. Nan Carter usually doesn't send funny books from Berkeley. She sends serious books. This is called Dispute Over a Very Italian Piglet. And it's by Amara, A-M-A-R-A, Lockhouse, L-A-K-H-O-U-S, an Algerian writer who lives in Italy and writes in Italian. But it deals with the same themes that Nan is interested in, and that is the way in which our culture is in transition. We are always filled with immigrants. Immigrants are moving in. Immigrants are moving out, and the problems they're caused. But the narrator here is a journalist who invents in order to get on the front page of his newspaper, invents a feud between immigrant Romanians and immigrant Albanians that turns out not to be true. On the upper floor just above his apartment, there's a Nigerian who keeps a pig. He's an immigrant too. And the pig ends up in some manner in a mosque and is condemned to death because that's fatal for Muslims. And there's an attempt to save the pig. There's a civil rights group that gets involved in the pig, too. So it takes place in Turin, Italy, which is in the north, and the Italy itself is being invaded by southerners who are coming up north with different customs. So it is what is going on all over the world, a world in transition, a world mm-hmm. confronting all sorts of new ways. But this is done in a very humorous, funny way.
Yeah, if people do have trouble when changes occur and their settled ways are threatened with something else. But what's the name of that book again?
Dispute Over a Very Italian Piglet.
Okay, and don't forget we have a number of books in the Scribble Lending Library
this
in the lobby.
This one is there.
Okay, we're adding more books, so help yourself. And help yourself to another airing of Scribble next week when Roll, Tweet, and I'll return.